Hello, friends, and welcome to season 4 of the Anditz Records podcast. This is your host, Oisy Ronsberger. This season, we will talk in depth about the reissue of the Shelter album, When 20 Summers Pass. This is the first part of my conversation with legendary straight edge icon Purcell, aka Paramananda Das. Today, we will talk about the end of Youth of the Day, his spiritual quest that followed, and how he ended up joining forces with his old friend Ray again when Purcell finally joined Shelter. All right, should we get into it?
Yeah, let's get into this.
Awesome. So what we do, like, before or around every release, we do this Anditz podcast where we talk in detail about the release we're going to do. And today I want to talk about, you know, 20 Summers Pass, the Shelter album. But I think to really talk about that, we need to talk about all those years before as well. And I want to start really early. In 1989, that's when you went on a Youth of Today tour in Europe, correct? And that's when the band broke up, or afterwards.
Correct.
Did at that point, Ray was already into Krishna consciousness for a while, right?
Correct. Easiest interview ever. I'm just answering. Correct or not correct?
How did you feel about it at that point?
I was very confused about it. I didn't know much about Krishna consciousness. What really confused me, like, I thought it was, you know, I thought it was a noble aim for him that he wanted to get into spirituality and he wanted to, you know, explore higher consciousness and try to become a better person. That part I could wrap my head around. And he was always kind of a guy like that. So it didn't surprise me when he was getting into things like that. But the fact that he would quit the band when the band was at our most popular, we had just broken into like a European market, like a whole new market of people were finding out about Youth of Today. And, you know, just like it was kind of a boom for Youth of Today in the United States in like, you know, 88. And then we had, you know, we did this 3-month tour in Europe and it just seemed like the whole thing was happening all over again. Like there's a big boom for the band and a lot of people were finding out about Youth of Today for the first time. And we were actually selling more records than we ever sold. And he just kind of gave it all up. And, you know, I couldn't figure it out. But, you know, spiritual life makes no material sense. We're not in this to make material sense. You're never going to make material sense. You're never going to have enough in this material world and have enough fame and followers and money. It's just there's no end to it. So at some point, you just have to, like, cut it. And you have to say, I'm going to go for something different.
Did you kind of feel, because at that point, like up until that point, the two of you seemed inseparable. Did you felt a little bit, you know, betrayed or left behind at that point?
The writing was on the wall even before that tour. Like he had kind of disappeared and he was just doing his own thing for maybe like 6 months even before that tour. Like even before the tour happened, you know, me and Walter would get together and we were, you know, we would talk about like, wow, I wonder what's going to happen with the band. We haven't seen Ray in months. You know, it was weird for us because we were young kids and we had 100% dedicated ourselves to the band. I mean, we went from like, you know, to graduating high school, doing Youth Today like full time with our full energy, 24 hours a day, everything, you know, our whole life revolved around the band. And so it was kind of a scary thing, like, you know, wow, this foundation that we're standing on is about to crumble. What's going to happen? So he kind of, even before that tour, he had kind of distanced himself a little bit from us. And so we weren't surprised at the end of that tour where he was just like, he wanted to quit the band before the tour. If we didn't have a European tour booked and that seemed kind of exciting to him because he had never been to Europe before, I am positive he would have quit the band when he came back from India because he had gone to India. He came back and right when he came back it was uncanny. It was almost like the day that he, as a matter of fact, they offered us a tour. When he was still in India, we were trying to get in touch with him while he was in India, which was like impossible. And so as soon as he came back, I think he had the intentions of quitting the band, but you know, we said, hey, we got this European tour, and he kind of took the bait. Thankfully, because it was an important tour for us, for sure.
So when you guys came back, that's when Youth of the Day broke up for good then, right?
Yes.
And Ray started to record Perfection of Desire with, you know, a bunch of friends. Did you know what he was doing at that point? Like, were you aware of the fact that he's doing this project, or?
He didn't do that project immediately. He came back, he quit the band, he moved into an ashram, and he was kind of bouncing around from different ashrams from New York, and he lived in DC for a while. And so he had basically quit music for maybe like 6 months. And I think it was, you know, maybe like after like 6 months where no one had seen or heard, you know, this was before the internet. This was before cell phones. This was like, you know, he left and we literally had no clue what happened to him. You know, there's no communication. There's no email. You know, literally if we wanted to get in touch with him, we'd have to write him a letter and we didn't even know his address because he was moving around a lot. So I didn't really even know that he had done a record or he was even planning on doing a record. Till I heard from Tom Capone. He asked Tom Capone to play on it. So this was like 6 months after he had kind of disappeared. And then Tom Capone came up to me. He said, hey, Ray's planning on doing this record. He asked me to play guitar on it. And that was the first that I had heard about it.
So you were obviously at that point not involved with the recording, but you ended up on that record with the first original version of the song Shelter that you programmed, right?
I actually didn't do the drum machine. The drummer did the drum machine. I did do something on that track.
Because you do have credits on the record sleeve. You are credited on that one.
I'm trying to think of what I did. I know I did something on that track. I think I redid the drums maybe that the drummer did.
How did you end up just getting involved for that one song?
Ray called me up and he asked me for some help with it. He still had my phone number and he just kind of called me out of the blue. And that's how we ended up doing that first Shelter tour. He called me out of the blue. He's like, I have this whole tour plan for my new band. I don't even think the record was out yet. And he said, I don't have anybody else to play guitar. Do you want to play guitar? And I said, yeah, sure. He goes, well, you're not going to get paid because I'm going to donate all the money to the temple. And I said, okay. So me and Sammy did that very first Shelter tour with Inside Out and Quicksand. That was an exciting tour.
Oh, I can imagine. What a lineup. At that point, so as far as I know, there was like a rolling temple, like a bus, you know, that got converted into a temple. A lot of devotees on tour with you. Mm-hmm. Are you still weirded out at that point? Or are you slowly easing into it?
Well, you know, there was two monks on that tour. Which is, it's just mind blowing. I mean, here you are, you're going on a tour. There's a huge bus, you know, like a converted bus. It has like a kitchen on it and everything, which is basically a bhakti program. They have all these new students that are interested in bhakti yoga and they're doing classes all day. They're doing, you know, they're waking up early, they're doing meditation, and they're also on a hardcore tour. And they're like distributing books on the tour and they're cooking and they're distributing food at all the shows. So if that's not weird enough, like they have two senior monks on the tour that are basically like taking care of all these like younger kids. And I got to say, those two monks were super nice to me. They were just like very, very kind and nice. And any questions that I had, they would take the time to, you know, explain things. And they kind of really endeared themselves to me on that tour. And I actually became, you know, good friends with them, you know, even to this, I mean, one of them has passed away now, but, you know, for the, you know, whatever the next, you know, few decades, I was very, very friendly with both of them.
Did you record the No Compromise 7-inch after that tour?
Yes.
Yes, because that also features you and Sammy again, right?
Right. Yeah, he asked. He said, "I need help again," and so we got together. We practiced a little bit, and you know, the songs were already written, but you know, I added a little, you know, some lead parts to them and stuff. And I really love that. You know, I always love that 7-inch.
Fantastic songs.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But you still don't end up joining the band. You record the 7-inch and you leave again?
I was in Judge. I was full-time committed to Judge. As a matter of fact, Judge played some shows with that very first lineup of Shelter. And the first lineup of Shelter had our drummer that played on Attaining the Supreme, Akendra. He wasn't even playing drums. He was playing bass or guitar maybe. And they had this other drummer that could barely play drums. I hate to say it, they were actually terrible. I remember when Judge played and it was like, oh, wow, you know, here's that band Shelter that Ray's doing. I was really excited. You know, I had heard the record and stuff. But, you know, when you're a Hare Krishna in a temple and you only have this very small pool of people to choose from, are there Hare Krishna monks, you know, to play, your chances of finding a person that can actually knows how to play hardcore and play it well is, you know, impossible. So he just took whoever he could. I think that I don't even think the drummer could play a drum set. I think the drummer just knew how to play the clay Murdunga drum. And so he was really, I just remember the drummer being really bad and the music just not being good.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Did that improve when Vic DiCara joined?
Yeah, it did. I think I did see Shelter with Vic. I think I saw them at, I'm trying to think how Vic was in the band. I saw them at City Gardens. And I think Vic was in the band and they were vastly improved. And that was probably like a year later. That's when I was in Gorilla Biscuits. That's when Judge had ended. And then I had joined Gorilla Biscuits. And then I caught them at City Gardens and they were good.
Is that around 91 when you also recorded the Ray and Purcell 7-inch?
Yeah, that was like 1990.
Okay.
That was at the same time I was in Gorilla Biscuits that we did that Ray and Purcell record.
Do you remember the backstory to that? Like, were you just crossing paths by accident with Ray, or?
I hadn't seen him in a long time, and you know, I was in it was like the 90s had hit, and everybody was starting to do different kinds of music. You know, like hard. You know, we had all been playing straight up thrash hardcore for years and years and years and years, and then you know, Walter was doing. He was doing like Moondog and starting like, you know, Quicksand and stuff like that. And it seemed that everybody was getting into different kinds of music. And so I was also experimenting, you know, just writing different kinds of music. And I was writing songs and I was good friends with Walter's little brother. And I lived on Avenue A. Walter's little brother used to just come over all the time. We were just kind of like friends and we would hang out. And he was really into hip hop. And he was into like industrial music, like Nine Inch Nails and stuff. And so I was writing songs and he said, yeah, let me program drums onto this stuff. And so he would do the drum machine stuff. And we were originally going to get a girl to sing on it. Like he knew some girl who was like a really, really good singer. And we were just going to write a bunch of pop songs, basically. And then the girl, for some reason, couldn't do it or she moved or something. So we had those songs, and then out of the blue, Ray called me up. He said, hey, I just got back from India. I'm at the airport. I need a place to stay for a couple of days. You think I could stay at your apartment? And I was like, yeah, sure. And he came down when I lived on Avenue A, and it was pretty interesting. Like, he was in my apartment. He was telling me, like, you know, I've been all these places, and I've, you know, I was just kind of fascinated at, like, he had been to India, like, twice at that point. He was telling me all about it. And then he was telling me, he was like, you know, you're just sitting here in New York, you're just doing the same thing. You should like move and broaden your horizons. And you know, you're living in the Lower East Side. This is like a dangerous place. And you know, you should really move and do something else. And then he had all this, he had all these clothes that he needed fixed. He needed to get them, bring them to a tailor. So we had this little Italian tailor that was like really cheap. He'd go in and like for a dollar, he would like fix your clothes. So I was like, yeah, I know this tailor. We'll go down the street. So me and him were walking down the street, we're walking down Avenue A right after he told me this stuff, like 5 minutes before. And two guys are arguing on the corner And one guy pulls out a knife and just stabs the other guy in the stomach right in front of us, right in front of us. The guy had a white t-shirt on, like just like an undershirt. And the guy grabbed his shirt like this, and you could just see the blood just kind of pulling out between his fingers. And you could see the white shirt was slowly getting stained with blood. And then he fell to the ground, and all these people kind of like rushed in to help him. And then Ray turned to me. He's like, "Yeah, man, you got to do something else with your life." And it was, I don't know. It was just one of those weird kind of defining moments in my life. Like, yeah, what am I doing on Avenue A? I got to make some changes. So I never forgot that time that the guy got stabbed.
So the universe gave you a pretty big sign, huh?
Yeah, it was something like that.
Did you then move to California at that point? Is that what happened?
After that, I moved to California. Pretty much like a month later, you know, I was even thinking like, you know, maybe New York's not like, I couldn't start a band in New York. And I was thinking maybe I'll go to California. It's sunny. I always like the beach and, you know, maybe I could start a band out there. So I moved out there. You know, I was friends with Zach from Inside Out, you know, from that tour and just, you know, from knowing him from going to California and stuff. So there was some talk about me and him doing a band. It never really like actually got off the ground. We did get together and, you know, we tried to write songs and he was going to sing, I was going to play guitar. It never got to the point where we actually got other members and got a full band and recorded anything. He almost immediately, when we started doing that, he immediately started doing Rage Against the Machine. And of course the rest is history. But California was very strange for me. Like, I think California was the start of my spiritual life. You know, I wanted to move to New York. Actually in New York, shortly after that had happened with the guy getting stabbed, I'd gone to a Bad Brain show in Uptown. And, you know, by this time, you know, the New York hardcore scene was always like a family. It was very, very tight. Everybody was friendly. Everybody looked out for each other. There might have been a few like fist fights here and there, but for, you know, by and large, everybody just kind of recognized like it's us versus the world kind of thing. And people just took care of their own. It was like a real community like that. And, you know, around like 1990, all these other kind of real thuggy sort of people started just getting attracted to just the violence and the ferocity of the music. And it really sort of, it lost that whole kind of family element. It got much bigger. A lot of, you know, metal kids were coming into the scene, you know, a lot of, you know, just people who weren't even into punk. They just were into like moshing basically. And it became super violent. And I went to a Bad Brain show and I got jumped by 10 skinheads, literally 10 skinheads jumped me. I got beat up really bad. And I was just thinking like, you know what? I need a change. New York is, you know, there's nothing left for me here. I'm just like, I'm not into the scene. And so Jordan had moved to California and he had offered me a job to pick bands because he was out there doing all the, you know, older releases and stuff like that, working all the older releases, but he didn't have anybody to kind of just get some new blood into the label. So he hired me, he brought me out there specifically to, you know, work on getting some new bands. And so I think the first band that I signed was Into Another, and I signed Orange 9mm, Sensefield, and that band Statue. Those were the four bands that I signed in that year that I was out there. And it was really strange for me because when I lived out there, it seemed on the surface that things were really good. Like I was living for free at Revelation. You know, I was getting, I was getting paid to do like A&R stuff. I had very low overhead. I was a few blocks from the beach. You know, I used to just jog to the beach every day and like work out on the beach. And on the surface, life seemed good. You know, I had some, you know, a lot of people knew about Youth Today. Like California was one of those places, especially Southern California, where people just loved Youth Today. Like that was one of our hotbeds where we would play a show in Southern California. You knew it was going to be off the hook. So, you know, I had like a little bit of recognition and, you know, money and kind of an easy life. And I lived at the beach. But I tell you, inside, I was really suffering. I was really suffering because I was just thinking, like, actually, I was super confused. I was super confused because I was like, why am I not happy? Why am I not happy? I have everything. I live by the beach. I can go swimming anytime I want. I'm eating veggie burgers and health foods every day. I'm going to, like, you know, it just seemed like I had everything that I wanted. And it wasn't like I was unhappy. It was like, it was almost like I was just unfulfilled in my heart. Like, for with Youth of Today, I think there was that sense of we're on a mission for the world, you know, like, as naive as that sounded, you know, we were straight edge and we were vegetarian. Those things were important. And we thought those things could, like, make a significant change in people's lives. And we were just, like, out there with a message and a mission. And there was some sense of, like, there was a great sense of, like, contribution, or at least trying to make some sort of contribution. And me as a person, I always liked that. Like, I wanted to have some sort of, like, deep purpose in my life that I was working towards. And I wasn't just, like, kind of living for myself. And when I was in California, it was like, it was almost just like, I'm living by myself. You know, I'm living for myself. All my activities are sort of like just kind of bringing things to me, but I'm not really actively contributing anything significant in the world. And it really gnawed at me. It gnawed at me. And I was just thinking, like, the whole time I was living this nice life, I was thinking, man, I'm unhappy. I'm unfulfilled. I got to make some changes. I don't even know what to do. Like, I literally was like that. I was like, I don't even know what to do. I don't even know where to start. So I figured, let me just move back to New York. And so I lived in California for a year and I just, like, up and moved. I just couldn't take it anymore. I was just like, I need to change my life again. And so I moved back to New York. And when I moved back to New York, it was with the headspace that it was almost like, I got to find the meaning of life, kind of deal. And it was at the time, you know, it was at that time where, you know, I think I was like 23 or something like that. And it's a time of life where you're not a kid anymore. Like, you're not a kid. You're an adult. You're still a young adult, but you're an adult and you got to start thinking, like, what do I want to do for the rest of my life? Do I want to play? And I was in that thing, like, do I want to just play hardcore and, like, punk rock? And, you know, do I want to do that for the rest of my, do I see myself doing that in 10 years? Ironically, here it is, like, 30 years later, I'm still doing it. But that was in my mind, like, you know, that's not really where I see myself in 10 years. I'd rather see myself in a different place.
But why did you think that New York was the place to go back to find yourself?
You know what? I think California was too nice. It was literally too nice. And it's just so easy when you live out there just to fall into, like, the allurement of just the niceness of it and just the comfort of it. And it's easy to live a shallow life out there. it really is. And so I think I was thinking that New York was a little bit more real. And that's really it. Like, it wasn't necessarily like I miss my friends, I miss New York. It wasn't really anything like that. As a matter of fact, when I moved back to New York, I really just kind of, like, isolated myself. I didn't really, like, hang out with too many people. And I was just, I got myself a job at a health food store. And literally what I would do for hours a day is read books. Like, I just, you know, I just wanted to read books and get some different experiences. You know, I was experimenting with all different kinds of diets. I was going to, like, raw foods. I got interested in herbology. I was taking herbology courses. I started doing Taekwondo and Tai Chi. And I was interested in, like, energy work and all sorts of kind of, like, new agey kind of things. But to me, they were fascinating. You know, meditation, like, all these things were, they were just kind of, like, fascinating. There were different worlds that I could broaden my horizon in. And so I was reading a lot of different kinds of, like, spiritual books. And they all kind of resonated with me to some point. But I think when I started reading Prabhupada's books, actually, you know, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, who was, you know, the leader of the, you know, he transplanted Krishna consciousness or spiritual consciousness to the West. I don't know what it was about those books. They really just spoke to me. And to me, they seemed practical. They seemed practical. These are some things that you can add to your life where you can have palpable spiritual experiences and you can watch yourself transform. Yeah, I started to get into it, and it's amazing how the universe works. It's amazing how Krishna works, because I think I was a pretty sincere, just kind of like seeker at that point in my life. And as soon as I started getting a little bit like this much into Krishna, all of a sudden, out of the blue, Steve Reddy, who now runs Equal Vision Records and merch now, and he's a huge kind of business success from nothing. Some just amazing success stories of Steve Reddy. His Christian name is Sachi Sutta. He had been living at Gita Nagari, which is his cow protection farm. And he had been farming for like, I think, a couple of years. And he called me up out of the blue and he said, I moved away from the farm. I think he went on tour with Into Another, actually. He goes, I just got back from tour for Into Another. I'm in New York. I literally don't have any place to go to. Like, I'm just sitting here with my backpack. I don't have any place to turn. Can I stay at your house? And he was our old roadie. Like, you know, I was friends with him I knew him from going to shows in Albany and stuff. He used to set up the shows in Albany. So I was like, sure, just come live in my house. And, you know, at that point, I was actually pretty lonely because I wasn't really hanging out with anybody, because at this point in New York, none of my old friends were straight edge. As a matter of fact, not only were they not straight edge, they were super into partying. Like, you know, they were going to bars and they were hanging out, and, you know, some of them were smoking cigarettes, and it just wasn't my scene, like, whatsoever. So I didn't hang out with any of my old friends, none of them. And so Steve came, and he came from the farm, and I was just like, hey, you know, I've been reading these books. What's the deal with this Krishna stuff? And so he used to start to, you know, tell me about it. And he taught me some, you know, he would teach me some of the prayers and some of the meditations. And it's just so weird how quickly I just like tumbled right over the edge. Like, from the time that Steve moved in with me, I think it was like 2 months before I had moved into a temple. And I just became super fascinated with it. And I think what really did it for me was Steve had a guru, and he was like, it's my guru's Vyasa Puja, which means your guru's birthday, where it's a celebration of your teacher, basically. And people kind of fly in from everywhere. And his guru's Vyasa Puja was in New York. And he goes, you want to come with me? We're going to go celebrate this with all my God brothers and God sisters. And so I said, yeah, sure, I'll go. He goes, well, it starts at 4:30 in the morning. It's at the temple and it starts at 4:30 in the morning. And I was like, yeah, I would love to go. And so I went, and it was at the Brooklyn Temple, and the place was, you know, the Brooklyn Temple is a big temple.
Yeah, I've been there before. It's huge. Yeah.
And it was packed. It was packed with, you know, this guru was there, and it was packed with all of his students. And it started out with like a huge kirtan. So a kirtan is where, you know, you chant different mantras, and it's accompanied by music and singing. Man, there was such an energy in that room, because here it is. It's like, you know, hundreds of people who have congregated from literally all over the world to sort of like give, you know, in deep gratitude to their teacher who had done so much to change their life in such a positive way. And here they all are, and their teacher is there. And, you know, they're chanting when there's like deep sense of gratitude, and you can feel it. Like, you can feel it. Like, I'm just a complete outsider coming in on this. And like, you know, it's 4:30 in the morning. I can barely keep my eyes open, but I'm just like, wow. And then, you know, what happens at these Vyasa Pujas is the guru sits down, and then the students will come with it. They'll write an offering, and they'll speak the offering of gratitude to the teacher. You know, these people were just like pouring their hearts out. Thank you so much. You know, Guru Dave, you've changed my life. And, you know, I feel my life changing in so many, you know, dramatic ways. And I feel like a peace in my life that I never had before. And it's all due to you. And thank you so much. There was so much love in that room there was so much like, you know, gratitude for these people who were saying how their lives were changing in so many amazing ways. And I was just thinking like, I want that. You know, that was like deeply, that was exactly what I was looking for. That was exactly what I was looking for. I was looking for meaning and purpose and, you know, gratitude and, a deep sense of like something higher than just like, whatever, making money and spending it on yourself and buying a bunch of stuff and having a good life. That never really attracted me. I always wanted to be a person like on a mission, like give me a mission, you know, not only was that, you know, and that went on for like a couple hours and I was just fascinated by it. But then the thing that fascinated me the most is when the teacher started speaking. And so here's this person, he's sitting on a big seat, you know, he's sitting on it's called a Vyasasana. He's sitting on a raised seat, like he's at the center. All these other people are around, they're pouring these heart out in these offerings of gratitude. And so he gets up there, and I was expecting him to be kind of like, you know, thank you, and you know, like sort of a big position. I was expecting some sort of like presidential kind of speech out of him, but he was so humble. He was so humble, and he started it out. He just said, I thank you so much for all of your sincere, you know, prayers and offerings. He said, if there's any good that you see in me, it's all due to my teacher. He's like, I was nothing. I was confused, lost person in this world. And my teacher, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, you know, he was a student of Prabhupada. My teacher, Prabhupada, came and he gave me everything and he changed the direction of my life. And I was just a lost, you know, student in my 20s in New York. And he came and just, he lifted me up and he lifted me out of the material world. And so I'm just praying that all of your gratitudes of offering, I'm just taking that all and I'm just passing it on to him because he's the person that really deserves it. And I was like, wow, that impressed me more than anything. Just the humility of that. And like, I was practically on the way out of that door. I was practically like, where do I sign up for this? Where do I sign up for this? This is what I want in my life.
So how long before you sell all your, you know, musical gear, your record collection, and move to the cow farm yourself?
Not long at all. two weeks. This whole thing happened so fast. I stumbled from the material world and fell off the spiritual cliff in like 2 months, literally.
And just, you know, to get the facts straight, at this point, Ray Raghunath knows nothing about what's going on in your life, like nothing, right?
This is before the internet. Like, people don't understand what it was like before cell phones and the internet. It was like the dark ages. Do you remember? How old are you?
It was, I'm 42 now. It was.
Yeah, so you remember.
Information
what it was
traveled slowly, and it just took forever to catch on to things and find out. And yeah.
Can you imagine? This is before beepers. Beepers. You couldn't get in touch with a person. Like, everybody had a landline at home, and if you weren't home to pick up that landline, you could not get in touch with the person. You had no idea where they were.
Yeah, especially with people like us that moved around so much, like no way to get in touch with anybody.
Yeah. And so it was at this point, I think a few days after that, Steve was just saying like, I want to move back to the farm. You know, he was just super inspired by his teacher and everything. And I think he was kind of feeling like he wasn't doing any real service. You know, Krishna consciousness is very service-based. Like, it's more about getting your head in the space of what can I give instead of what can I get. And so I think he was in New York and he was kind of like taking a break and sort of finding himself a little bit. But I think he had that same feeling, like, I'm not really doing any service. I would rather go to this farm and do a lot of active service and take care of the cows, take care of the animals and do the farming. And truth be told, they needed people at that farm. They had a huge farm. I think they had 150 cows and barely anybody to take care of them. So I'm pretty sure that they had contacted him and kind of like said, please come back. Because here's something about Steve. Steve's a big, strong, driven dude. He can do the work of four people. And I've seen it. I've seen that guy. He will literally do the work of four people. He's pretty amazing.
So he's the horse in animal farm.
Exactly. Like when it comes to physical labor, you ain't outdoing that guy. Like, no way. And so we ended up, and so he said, do you want to move to the farm with me? I was like, yeah. I was like, I really do.
Did you have any farm experience or any contact with animals before you moved to that farm?
Absolutely none. None. I couldn't even, at that point, I couldn't even put gas in a car. Like, I had just been living in the city for so long. You know, if anything breaks in your apartment, you just call the landlord. The landlord comes and fixes it. I couldn't do anything but play guitar, but I learned very, very quickly. And it was a lot of hard work, but I actually liked it. Like, I'm sort of a physical guy too. Like, I like activity. I like, you know, physical activity. I like to work out. I like yoga. So that part I actually liked. Like, you know, from literally after breakfast, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning till literally 8 o'clock at night, we were doing like hard physical labor, chopping down trees, you know, putting up fences, taking care of cows, a lot of shoveling, baling hay. You know, it was awesome. And for me, it was such a breath of fresh air because I was, you know, even from when I was living in the city, even in like the Youth Today days, we were super into natural living. We were into vegetarianism and eating healthy and eating organic food, exercising. And, you know, here I was, and this was sort of like the pinnacle of healthy life. You know, you're growing your own food. The food that you're eating, it was picked that morning, sometimes by me. You know, going out to the garden, picking all the food for everybody. You know, the food is fresh, it's organic, it's freshly prepared. You're outside in the fresh air, in the countryside. It was super healthy, and it was a really nice break just from, I mean, can you imagine at this point, I had been like 6 years of constant touring in the crazy hardcore scene, like fights and riots and getting beat up and getting jumped and people throwing beers at me for years on end and like getting hit with a bottle in the face. You know, it was just like, it was a crazy 6 years. I'm not complaining. It was awesome. But, you know, it was nice to just take a break and just be out in the country and just kind of like slow the freaking pace down finally after years of, you know, nonstop, just, you know, going from 10 to 11. so it was nice. And
but as we know, obviously, there's Raghunath already lurking around the corner, right, to drag you back into punk rock life. How did that happen?
You know, that's a pretty, you know, I've told this story a million times, but, you know, he found out that I was living there. And it was another one of those weird Krishna arrangements. Like, Vic had quit the band. They were looking for a guitar player. They couldn't find anybody. They didn't know what they were going to do. They were even thinking about breaking up the band. And then all of a sudden, some kid who's at the Sunday Feast in Philadelphia says, why don't you get Purcell? I heard he lives on that Krishna farm now. And they were like, what? And they couldn't even get in touch with the farm because the farm only had one phone and no one would even answer that phone. So to find out if I was actually there, pre-internet, pre-cell phone, they had to get in the shelter van and physically drive, you know, hours and hours and hours to the farm to see if I was even actually there, which they did. And, you know, then I ended up joining the band and moving to Philly. And I tell you, it was a good thing for me. Because even though that was a really nice detox and a break for me, I'm a very social person. I love adventure. You know, I'm not a type of person that, I don't even know how much longer, you know, and that life was super isolated. Like, I, you know, there was, first of all, there was probably only maybe 8 people living on the whole farm. Like, there would be days where the only other person that I would see for the whole entire day was Steve. And I would barely see him because he took care of the bull barn and I took care of the cow barn. And so it was just so much work to do that our paths may cross a few times during the day just to, like, you know, spread the manure on the fields and stuff like that. You know, something we couldn't do by ourselves that we had to do, you know, with 2 people, or, you know, to put up a fence or something. But it was a super isolated life, and I don't like that. Like, some people are real introverts and they like to just be by themselves all the time and just to be away from people. They love it. Give them a few good books. They're perfectly happy. I am not like that. I'm like a pirate. Send me off on an adventure. You know, that's just not me. So it came at the perfect time because I was there for about 6 months. So I had a really nice time just to take a nice break and just like slow down the pace of my life and really, you know, get more into my spiritual life and do a lot of active service in a really like healthy environment. I think it did wonders for me, but it was the perfect time for me to switch gears and actually do something that was more suited to my nature.
So at that point, Vic left. Was that hard for you, you know, to follow in his footsteps? Because he's such an eclectic guitarist, like so different from your style.
I didn't really think too much about it. Shelter was actually pretty hurting, just as far as the band went. Like they could never get a steady lineup. When they first started, you know, musically the band was just like, you know, not good. The musicianship wasn't there. So I think the band kind of needed a little shot in the arm. And I think, you know, with me joining the band, people were just like, oh my God, Ray and Purcell is back together again. This is so cool. You know, that's what the band actually needed. The band needed like a little bit of a lift. And so I didn't really feel pressured that I had to like follow in the footsteps of Vic. I mean, Vic was only in the band for maybe like, I don't even know, maybe a year or something like that. And so I just figured I was just going to come in and put my own stamp on the whole thing anyway, which I was excited to do.
Yeah, you guys quickly went in and recorded Attaining the Supreme, right? With
John
Fury. And for me, that's like when the band is spiritually firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, we were all monks, 100% dedicated to monk life. It was really, it was cool. First time in history that a bunch of monks make a hardcore album.
So at that point also, that record is such a specific sound, like almost like in indie. And if I talk about indie, I mean like early REM, The Smiths, you know, Sofer's Revolution, 7 Seconds.
It's interesting that you name those three because those three were probably huge influences on me.
Nailed it.
REM, I mean, definitely REM, The Smiths. You can hear stuff like that on the record, especially in like the little kind of Johnny Marr-ish leads that I started developing at that time. And yeah, like 7 Seconds moving into a more kind of like indie rock direction. You know, first of all, it was the 90s. And if you remember if anybody just historically looks back at the 90s, the music scene was like anything goes. It was a real exciting time if you were a musician. Because here I was, you know, in the 80s, and I felt so pigeonholed in like, okay, Youth Today has a certain sound. You can't break that mold. You know what I mean? We almost defined that mold. So in order to kind of get out of that, we really had to like break up the band and do something different. So I never felt that like ball and chain around my leg with Shelter that here's this certain kind of, this certain mold that you have to fit in and you have to write all your songs very rigidly in this formula because that's what people expect out of you. I think the 90s came and people were just so sick of being confined like that as musicians, even like Walter doing Quicksand and, you know, Richie Underdog doing Into Another, which was like a, you know, it almost sounded like Judas Priest with like, you know, falsetto. Like it was just like, and it was cool. Like everybody wanted something different. So even when we were doing that Attaining the Supreme record, it was like, you know, we were into experimenting with different sounds, experimenting, you know. Ray actually has a good voice. Like Ray can sing.
I mean, that's probably like he's at his most experimental yet best, like on that record. Like his range is so diverse. It's fantastic.
Yeah. So we wanted the music to kind of reflect the fact that, hey, this guy can actually sing. Like, let's make a platform that's really going to kind of carry his voice. And that's how Attaining the Supreme came out. Really cool record.
How did you write those songs?
When I got into the band, almost immediately, I literally moved into the temple. You know, I had like 3 Dodies and I was given a milk crate to put all my stuff in. So you only had you can only own enough stuff that would fit into a milk crate. And I think I had like a few books and I don't know, maybe like one pair of jeans and like, I think I had a pair of Vans or something. Everything had to fit in the milk crate. Everything else you couldn't take. And the very next day after I unpacked my stuff into that milk crate, we literally started, you know, getting ready to, you know, write and record Attaining the Supreme. Like literally the next day we, you know, they already had a studio in Philly somewhere and we went there and we started working on the record. And they actually had a bunch of those songs already written. I think Graham, you know, Better Than a Thousand, Graham Land, somehow or other, he had come in. I'm not sure of the timeline, but he had come in with those guys and he had helped write some of those songs. Nothing was really like fully written. It was just kind of like riffs that Graham had come up with. And some things were like close to songs, but we really just like took all of Graham's riffs. You know, I would add some riffs to that. And then we would just like go in the studio and we started like really solidifying all the songs.
Is that the record where you guys made like, how do you want to put that, like huge steps career-wise already? Like, did you feel the impact of that record in turnouts and record sales?
The record was definitely well received. And the shows were fantastic. Like when that record came out and we started touring, man, those are some of the most exciting shows that I ever played. I don't know what it was, but it just, you know, it was an interesting time in America because it just seemed like that record came out and the whole scene, all of a sudden you would play shows and the whole scene had Krishna beads on. You know, it was like that time in the 90s where like Krishna was kind of cool in the scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody had neck beads. Everybody like, you know, people would like, you ask anybody that was in the hardcore scene in the 90s if they had ever been to a Krishna temple, and 99% of them are going to say yes. Like at least every hardcore kid went and visited the temple at least once and, you know, figured what are they shelter guys into? I got to at least check it out like at least once. So it was cool. The record came out and it was super well received and the shows were fantastic.
So when did you guys attract you know, the major label world, for lack of a better word? When did you notice that not only the scenes reacting super well to the band, the message, when did you see that the industry is also getting interested in Shelter there?
It was really, really strange because we started getting calls even when we were in Philadelphia, when we were still all living in Philadelphia. We were getting calls. First, we started getting calls from these different like indie labels that were starting to get like, that were starting to get like really big. Like at this, you know, it was so weird. Nirvana came out, Nirvana exploded, and it just like opened a door for punk and hardcore. And then it was like, then, you know, like Rancid was next and The Offspring and, you know, Green Day came and just like the, like that sort of music was just exploding. And these bands, I mean, Shelter played with Green Day, opened up for Shelter a couple of times. Green Day opened up for Shelter. I saw Green Day open a show at City Gardens. I forget what show it was, but Green Day played first. They were always great. I remember thinking like this band is like incredible, but they were like an opening band. And then the next thing you know, they're on MTV and they're selling millions of records and they're literally the biggest band in the world. So they opened this huge door and, you know, these major labels were crazy over like, we got to get the new Green Day. And so they were signing everybody, like, you know, Into Another got signed and, you know, Orange Nine, practically every band that I signed to Revelation got signed to these like huge multi-million dollar deals with major labels. Of course, I never got a kickback for it. But anyway, yeah, so we started getting interest from like other kind of bigger independent labels. And then it was weird, like major labels started calling us. And we were regularly taking trips to New York. And I think Ray had the idea like we should just move to New York. Like, you know, this music scene is about to explode. We should just up and move to the Brooklyn Temple. And those guys had all moved to the Brooklyn Temple before I did. I stayed in the Philly Temple for maybe like another 6 months. I don't know why I stayed there. I think my guru actually asked me to stay for a little bit longer because I was sort of like overseeing all these like younger kids that came to the temple. And I think he wanted me to be there to sort of take care of these kind of teenager kids who were very serious about Krishna who were coming to the temple. That was like the Prema guys and all their friends, you know, that band Prema that was on Equal Vision.
Oh, Mickey Prema.
Yeah, Mikey Prema and all those guys. So I sort of stayed there for like another 6 months. And those guys had moved to New York, but I would regularly give me, they were all living at the Brooklyn Temple. The temple president had given shelter their own room. And so regularly I'd be at the Philly Temple. They'd be like, you got to take the train up here. Sony is taking us out to eat. You know, I remember one time we went out, I think it was Sony took us out to eat. And Rick Rubin was at the next table and he was trying to, and he had that band, he had that label Deaf American that Danzig was signed to. So here's Sony, we're at one table, they're trying to sign Shelter. And then very next table next to us is Rick Rubin talking to this other band. He's trying to sign them, you know, to his label. And it was just, it was a real kind of exciting time for us. You know, we were like, oh my God, that, you know, if you're a musician, that's your wildest dream come true. You get signed to a huge label and you become a big rock star. And it almost seemed like, wow, this might happen.
So you signed to Roadrunner, and I think that is very well documented. You did this great podcast, the Meep Meep, lately about mantra,
yeah,
with some great, yeah, stories in there. But I want to, you know, how did it feel for you to be swapped up in this wave? You know, at some point, the band's taking off. You're going to Europe. You're playing huge festivals. You go to Brazil. You kind of become pop stars. You're on MTV all over South America. Like, how did that initially feel at that point?
Well, it was funny because when we first got signed to Roadrunner, we had such lofty ambitions of getting signed to a major label that we were actually super disappointed. We're like, oh, we're just on Roadrunner. I remember we had an offer from, what's that major label? They signed The Explosion. Remember that band from Boston, The Explosion?
Yeah. I think it was East West or Atlantic, I think, yeah.
Something like that. They actually gave us, they actually had an offer on the table for us to sign. But it was a really super bad deal. Like, they wanted our publishing and they, you know, it was like just one of these completely exploitive deals where, you know, sign away your soul if you want to be on a major label type deal. And so we had a lawyer and the lawyer was like, you guys are crazy to sign this deal. It's a terrible deal. Roadrunner's giving you like the greatest deal in the world and they love you guys, like they're fans of the band, like it makes way more sense for you to go with them. And it was a really, 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 really good decision for us.
Thank you very much for listening to the End Hits podcast. If you enjoyed this episode as much as we did, please send us feedback, share it with your friends, subscribe to the podcast, or give us a review. Stay safe and take care.